This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 9th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE for your personal enjoyment. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're going to talk about this week some of the things the IRS and the courts and other areas have brought out this week regarding the area of federal taxes. And we're going to start this week with a new proposed revenue ruling, a revenue procedure, actually. This is going to propose a safe harbor for gamblers for recording slot machine winnings on a daily basis. Now, as we're all aware, generally a gambler is only allowed to deduct losses to the extent of winnings. As you may also know, the way slot machines work is one places a wager, sends the wheel spinning, and then that particular wager either pays off or doesn't. Now, of course, that means that the average slot machine player playing slots at the casino is going to have many, many, many single transactions all through the day. Now, in theory, we could have to go back and figure out the winning ones and track them separately from another stack that is the losing ones on a per-pull basis. Generally, that's not been required, and as this particular notice, Notice 2015-21, notes, generally, the courts and the IRS accept a daily basis for this purpose for session or a session testing. But sessions are on a basically facts and circumstances basis. So what this is going to do is recognize that since the rules came out many years ago, slot machines and casinos basically have now got electronic record keeping. The slots themselves are electronic, and the casinos are keeping electronic records with the various players' cards, etc. So this will hopefully allow them to make use of that electronic system to give to track the player's winnings or losings. So under this ruling, a session would be considered playing the same type of game, that is slots, at the same casino during a 24-hour period that starts at midnight and ends the next midnight. So it is a cutoff based on a day and based on the day at the location you are at. What would happen there is if you have a player who's using electronic tracking where they put their cards in the machine, if they elect, each day can be treated as a separate session, and therefore the casino could issue them a report that would have their winning days, losing days, a per-day win-lose calculation, and that per-day win-loss calculation would be able to be used for reporting on their tax returns for the gambling at slot machines at that casino under the proposed revenue procedure, which, by the way, is still proposed, so this is not yet stating that this was one that the IRS yet deems acceptable. But under the proposed ruling, if you kept going at the same casino, so let's say you gambled in the morning until you started in the morning and you gambled until like noon, then you walked away, you decided to go out, take a look at the scenery, you come back to that casino at 6 o'clock that night, and you pick up at the slots again. The entire day would be considered one session, so we wouldn't pay attention to the fact that you had that 6-hour break. We'd simply treat that as one day. Similarly, if you're gambling through the middle of the night, so you're there at the machines at the stroke of midnight, there would be a cutoff right at midnight that would cut off the prior day and start a brand new session. You couldn't have sessions that would go over midnight. Again, this is elective, so a taxpayer could argue for other ways of having sessions. But if you decide to use this safe harbor, you must use it under the proposed revenue procedure for all gambling, gambling of that type at that particular casino for that year. Also under the rule, if the gambler goes into the casino and let's say we played our session in the morning, we put our card in, we go in back in the evening, we don't put our card in, that would not be able to be combined with the electronic session. The electronic session would stand alone. The IRS is asking for comments on this. Now, this is tied in because the same day they issued some proposed regulations that would change the reporting for other types of gambling that now the casinos are doing more electronic tracking on that would govern the reporting for purposes of issuing the 1099s. So this appears to be all part of that same project. It also appears the service would like to pick this up here before the end of the year. So it appears they would like to have it in place for 15 returns and that therefore we'll use it from that point forward or that our clients can use it for that. Until then, remember that right now we're still on a per session basis. So if you take a look based on the case law, if you have that sort of record from a casino, it certainly appears that the type of system they're talking about would most likely be considered an acceptable method by the tax court of determining what a session is if applied consistently. So it's probably not a bad thing to go look at, A, because you may find that that is the way you're going to advise, because if this becomes and becomes a final revenue procedure, you can certainly expect casinos will get their player club systems tied in so they can produce this output. In fact, that's the whole reason the IRS is working with them to try to get something that'll work. And secondly, you know, your clients just need to be aware that this is how you work. Or if the client wants to use a different system, doesn't like this, they need to start developing their own record-keeping system that will allow them to have a supportable session testing of their own that they may be using. Now we're going to continue on to a case that repeats, unfortunately, something that we've seen all too often. That is a 1099-C that simply doesn't comport with reality. This is the case of Bacon versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2015-15. Now, interestingly enough, as it was in the case of Kleber versus Commissioner, which was TC Memo 2011-233, the offending party in this case that's issuing a 1099-C that does not comport with reality is, again, an agency of the federal government. In Kleber, it was the United States Navy. In the case of Bacon, the offending agency is the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. In this case, the taxpayer had claimed a property that she owned was her principal residence, and it was damaged in the Northridge earthquake. The taxpayer therefore got assistance funds from FEMA. FEMA later determined that the property did not meet the requirements to be treated as the taxpayer's principal residence. Therefore, FEMA determined that she owed them money back. They made this determination in 2001, or I should say made this determination in 1996. 5 years later, this particular determination became one where if the government had not collected the money, they could no longer file a claim. FEMA sent it to the DOJ in 97, but the DOJ took no action. So in 2001, the government lost the ability to basically file a claim against this taxpayer. What that means in reality is, in 2001, there was cancellation of debt. But there's a hitch here. The FEMA didn't issue a 1099-C that year. And while the case doesn't comment on this fact, we can probably suspect that Ms. Bacon did not report that as income on her 2001 return. But for all practical purposes, her failure to report it is not relevant at this point. Rather, we continue on. In January of 2008, FEMA finally, for reasons not necessarily clear to anyone, decided to issue the 1099-C for the cancellation of debt. They finally noticed this debt. They decided we're going to issue a 1099-C to this taxpayer. So they did in 2007. The IRS, of course, got that 1099-C, did a matching program, found it was not on Ms. Bacon's return, and they came after her for the tax. In tax court, the IRS had a little problem here. The court noted that the government had lost its right to go after her for this debt in 2001. In the case of cancellation of debt, we are always looking for the identifiable event that shows that the lender does not plan to collect the balance and the borrower doesn't intend to pay it back. Well, Ms. Bacon apparently didn't intend to pay it back, and the government, by 2001, lost the ability to go after her. So the court determined that basically, regardless of any other issue that might have occurred, by 2001, the debt was clearly discharged. Since it was discharged in 2001, the IRS does not get to just pick and choose the year in which to have it taxable, even when the taxpayer failed to report it in the year of 2001. The fact the IRS was not told of this by FEMA until 2008, or for a 2007 return, is not, unfortunately, to the IRS's view, relevant. Rather, it was a 2001 cancellation, therefore 2001 was the proper year to report. We're going to probably continue to see this coming down from various agencies. We have seen banks do this wrong. We have seen the federal government do it wrong. It is a consistent problem we have with 1099-C reporting. You may wish to watch for clients who did have cancellation of debt during the real estate crisis that occurred about a decade ago, or a little less than a decade ago, and that ran for a few years. You may wish to be on the alert that we may be seeing these 1099-Cs many years later after the cancellation event has actually taken place. That means your taxpayers really do need to accumulate all the data and hold it to show why the debt was actually rendered irrelevant in an earlier year. That's especially true if the taxpayer in the earlier year could exclude that cancellation of debt and therefore reported and excluded it. We are probably going to continue to see these 1099C problems with things being issued too late. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in the case of North Central Rental Leasing LLC versus United States sustained a district court who told basically the taxpayer that their leasing program, their like-kind exchange program, was essentially too good to be true, and that they had to pay tax on the gain. They had a like-kind exchange program that was structured effectively in the view of the court to attempt to avoid the related party like-kind exchange rules. Now remember, under the related party like-kind exchange, if we exchange property with a related party, and that party disposes of the property within 2 years, generally we have to recognize the gain. What happened in this case, though, and there is also a provision that's noted here at 1031F4, that provides if you structure a transaction to basically technically avoid a related party like-kind exchange with the intent of avoiding this rule, that we will nevertheless apply the rule. What North Central Rental and Leasing did, this is the background here, we have basically there, they were a subsidiary mainly controlled by a parent company, in this case, which was the parent company Butler Machinery and Equipment. Butler Machinery and Equipment sold equipment, mainly Caterpillar equipment, and they also leased it. Just before they started this program, they basically formed a subsidiary and put the leasing program into the subsidiary. And the leasing program, 99% of the leasing company was owned by Butler Machinery, and the leasing company is North Central Rental and Leasing. And 1% was held by the majority owner of Butler Machinery. And by the way, all the other owners of Butler are related members of the family. What happened in this case was they did this because Caterpillar had a program where if you bought machinery from Caterpillar as a dealer, you effectively had 6 months to pay Caterpillar. So here's what Butler was doing. They wanted to basically, as their rental equipment aged and they got rid of it, they wanted to be able to like-kind exchange that for new equipment because, of course, they would have fully depreciated this, and they therefore did not want to trigger the gain when they sold that equipment, when they sold that equipment off to another party as used equipment. So what they did was they formed these two parties. When North Central Rental and Leasing went to sell a piece of property, they entered into a like-kind exchange agreement, and they brought in a third-party intermediary, Accruit, who would sell the equipment to the third party, receive the funds. Then North Central Rental and Leasing would acquire new equipment through Butler Machinery, right? Remember the parent company, the dealer? And Butler would therefore deliver the machinery. Accruit would therefore buy the machinery. Butler would, Accruit would deliver the funds to Butler. Butler would get those funds from the sale of the equipment, plus take another note from North Central Leasing, Rental and Leasing for any remaining balance due on the equipment. And then Butler, and therefore at that, from that point then, North Central Rental had cash in hand. At this point, they would then hold on to that cash for the 6 months while waiting before the payment date came up for Caterpillar. Apparently, the manufacturer had suggested this sort of arrangement to Butler Machinery as a way to take advantage of that six-month financing program that Caterpillar put in place. The IRS came in and screamed foul. They're saying what's really happening here is this is effectively a like-kind exchange where you're basically holding on to the money. You sell the property, you hold on to the money for 6 months, and then you get rid of it later. As we all know, generally in a like-kind exchange, touching the funds is basically kills the like-kind exchange treatment. And you can't. And the related party rules of 1031 are meant to specifically avoid the ability of being able to do that, of getting your hands on the money in a related party. In this particular case, the taxpayer, of course, claimed, no, this does not meet the requirements. And the IRS agreed it didn't technically. They were not technically exchanging property with Butler Machinery. they're rather exchanging with Accruit, and Accruit was handling the sale. But the IRS said this was clearly structured to avoid the like-kind rules for related parties because Butler Machinery had no intention of holding the property. What the tax court decided was, the Eighth Circuit. The Eighth Circuit looked to two cases that had come down before from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And in those two cases, which basically came down in 2009 and 2010, the courts in that case said they looked for a case of was there unnecessary complexity in the transaction, that was a strong indicator, if it otherwise kind of smelled, that was a strong indicator that the transaction was one that was structured to run afoul of this. In this case, the Eighth Circuit pointed out there was no reason why North Central Leasing, who was also a Caterpillar, had a Caterpillar license, could not have simply bought the equipment from Caterpillar. They said the only reason to do it this way was, and there was no reason to involve Accruit, because Accruit wasn't needed. In essence, they could have acquired the machinery. The only reason to go through this whole rigmarole, because North Central could have gotten the six-month float, North Central could have basically gotten the machinery. The only reason to go through all of this was to attempt to structure a deal so they could basically use the money for 6 months. Therefore, the Eighth Circuit, agreeing with the Ninth and 11th, held that such a complicated structure was by definition going to run afoul of these rules. In the case of Pilgrim's Pride Corporation versus Commissioner, which was reversed, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, 115 AFTR 2nd, 2015-411, the tax court ruling that said that Section 1234 Cap A automatically meant that if you tried to abandon stock or a partnership interest, that was going to be a capital loss because you abandoned rights, and 1234A says abandonment of rights always triggers a capital loss. The Fifth Circuit found that that was not appropriate, that this rule only applied if only rights and not the asset were abandoned. The advantage of this is that it may save Revenue Ruling 93-80 for partnerships. 93-80 says if I abandon a partnership interest and there is no debt allocated to me, that abandonment is an ordinary loss. The hitch in this case was the tax court said, well, when they looked at Pilgrim's Pride, they said, well, 1234A was enacted in 97 after Revenue Ruling 93-80. Therefore, Revenue Ruling 93-80 didn't take that into account. And therefore, yeah, we agree, you can't do that anymore, because Pilgrim's Pride has said, trying to protect their loss on the disposal of stock, that, well, that old ruling should apply. Now, the IRS has since issued regulations that would make the abandonment of stock considered to still be automatically worthless, but that would not apply to partnerships. They have never changed Revenue Ruling 93-80. The good news is it appears that this at least gives you a strong argument that you could still attempt to abandon a partnership interest and get an ordinary loss treatment. So Pilgrim's Pride reversed. Bad news, of course, is it's reversed in the Fifth Circuit only. Officially, it's still a published tax court ruling, 141 TC number 17. That means that, at least for now, officially the tax court position is that outside the Fifth Circuit, they still take the position that you can't walk away from this stuff. We'll see if other circuits come up with the same idea, or if the IRS changes their position on this. We also have a couple of cases to close out here. Panetta versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2015-16. In this case, a taxpayer's failure to review a return before signing it was fatal to her later attempt to claim innocent spouse treatment. The problem on the return was that this particular individual, Ms. Panetta, she had her former spouse would simply prepare the tax return, and Ms. Panetta basically apparently couldn't be bothered to review it. There's no suggestion in the court that she was threatened or otherwise coerced to sign the return. She simply, when the return was done, she came back in with that, well, where do I sign? And she signed there and sent the return off. Well, it turned out the return had a number of overstated deductions on her business. Of course, she didn't notice that because she didn't look at the return. When the IRS examined it and suddenly issued a tax assessment and she looked at the return, she basically agreed that, yeah, that stuff was obviously overstated. Those deductions weren't there. So as soon as she actually looked at it, she discovered there was a problem. Now, she tried to claim innocent spouse relief, claiming that under 6015C, well, she was no longer married to her ex-husband, and therefore she claimed and the error was his, so she shouldn't be liable for it. Now, the court ignored, the court said, let's just start a very basic test. You can't get 6015C relief unless you can show you were not aware of the understatement. They said in this case, now she claimed, well, of course I wasn't aware. I didn't look at it. The court didn't find very much sympathy for that intentional ignorance defense, stating effectively that since as soon as she looked at the return, it was obvious to her that they were misstated, they were going to deem that she had knowledge, or I guess we should probably restate that to say, if she had not basically shirked her duty, she would have had knowledge of the understatement. Therefore, she can't get out of it under filing for innocent spouse relief. Finally, for those of you with farmer clients, notice 2015-22 has provided relief from farmers who are unable to file their returns by March 1st, which of course gives you the special extended time to pay the tax due without underpayment penalties, because of the snafus with the forms 1095As that were issued with erroneous numbers by the federal government. If a taxpayer is affected by this, this notice tells you how to fill in Form 2210-F, and as long as you file that return by April 15th, you will be able to get out of those underpayment penalties. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March 9th, 2015. You can find more information about all these issues on our online site at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we have write-ups about current developments in federal taxes, as well as links to all of the source documents behind this week's discussion, so visit us there at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We'll see you next week when we'll talk about the upcoming, about the developments in federal taxes that take place coming up in this final week before the official, the initial, shall we say, unextended deadline for all those December 31st corporations.